So we just got back from a two-week road trip to Boston. So we spent the last couple of days in the car. Pasha got invited to take part in a symposium of fellow nerds talking about time and space and physics and related topics. And of course, we thought this would be a perfect excuse to pack a toddler and an infant into a car and drive 3,000 miles. Although that probably sounds like an exercise in madness, we actually really enjoyed it, partly because we had the opportunity to reconnect with friends and family, but also because it's such an interesting experience to meet people from a different culture, a different region of the country, and to get to hear some stories from people that are a little different from us. Also, we drank a lot of coffee, so that was an added bonus. But, you know, it's so interesting to travel in that way, driving, because you go through places of the country you might not ordinarily visit. And although we recognized that, you know, people are kind of the same no matter where we go, we also recognize that we were and do live in sort of a bubble of people similar to us. Our bubbles can get pretty opaque over time. You guys may have noticed this. I think I mentioned before that I am what you might call an avid Facebook user. I learned recently that Facebook employs a particular algorithm to decide what it is you're going to see. And so what it does is if I interact with, like, the Washington Post, then Facebook updates the algorithm so that next time I'm scrolling, I'll see more similar articles to what I just saw, things from Washington Post or New York Times or whatever. And conversely, every time I go past something like a Fox News article, Facebook makes a note and shows me fewer news postings from that source. Over time, what this yields is significantly different feeds for people, such that conservative friends of mine might see something completely different from me. The comparisons are pretty interesting if you look at them side by side. Facebook and other social media aren't the only way this happens, though. Most of us work in jobs with people who have similar levels of education. We live in neighborhoods with people who have similar earnings. And we patronize similar kinds of stores and restaurants to people that we know. So over time, we get, like, cloistered more and more inside this bubble of people who are like us. The result is that we can become blind to large swaths of our world. And these are swaths of the world that God has called us to dwell in. So in the book of Luke, one of the primary concerns that Jesus is addressing is the scribes and the Pharisees and their inability to look beyond their little world. To do this, Jesus tells a lot of very interesting, sometimes on-the-nose stories to communicate with an audience that is sometimes not so willing to hear him. We were just joking about this in Faith Forum, but when I saw the text for the week, I was kind of wondering if Blair was testing me. Because this is a pretty eyebrow-raising text. I mean, I think we all kind of go, is this really the gospel when we hear something that's talking about somebody being left in hell forever and ever? Jesus tells this story about the rich man, and he wears fancy purple. Purple is a color of royalty. Robes, and he eats good food and lives a pretty privileged life. And conversely, a crippled beggar named Lazarus, who lives on his stoop. And he hangs out there hoping for table scraps and basically waiting to die. As happens in life, they both did die, the rich man and Lazarus. And Jesus describes this experience of them after death. So he says that the rich man is in the fires of Hades, staring longingly across a great chasm, and Lazarus is now being comforted in the bosom of Abraham. Poor rich man, seeing Lazarus in comfort while he's suffering, he calls out for help and asks that Abraham send Lazarus to bring him a drop of water to cool his tongue. Or, barring that, at least send Lazarus to go and tell his brothers that they need to change their ways so that they might not suffer the same fate. Abraham responds in no uncertain terms that the rich man is a day late and a dollar short, and that he'll continue to burn there for all eternity. Yikes. All of us who ascribe to the idea that we are saved by grace and not works kind of like uncomfortably pull on our collars and grimace whenever we run across passages like this. There are a lot of different interpretations of this. One that I've heard before, a common interpretation from more literal theologians, is that you need to make a particular effort in life to do good things, otherwise you're going to go to hell. Some more subtle ones pull on things like part of the passage we just heard, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and something Jesus later says, if you want to be perfect, sell all that you have and give it to the poor. And the conclusion, of course, is that comfort at the expense of others in this life will lead to condemnation in the next. But also conversely, that people who suffer in this life will be taken care of, which is sort of an offering of hope, but I think it leaves a lot of us who live in the U.S., in this part of the city and, you know, in the social status where a lot of us happen to inhabit, that, well, where's the hope for me in this? There's no question to me that this parable is sending a strong message to the scribes and the Pharisees that they need to change their ways. That seems fairly obvious. But to me, there's more than simple moral instruction to this. And there's also more than the theology of who goes to heaven and who goes to hell. I think that this passage, this parable, actually speaks to the utter backwardness of what we are often taught to value. I worked at the University of Minnesota Hospital for a couple of years, and while I was working there in the behavioral health units, one thing that I noticed come up again and again was this deep sense of shame. Because we are inundated in our culture with ideas of who we should be, what we should be like, what we should look like, how we should parent. It extends to all of us, and it creates a sense of not being good enough over time. We all fall victim to the culture that tells us these things, and unconsciously and consciously, we hold ourselves and others to the standards that we learn from our society. We do it even when it's extremely harmful to ourselves. The rich man is no different. Feeling like he had achieved a certain level of success and righteousness, he had become blind to the suffering of Lazarus. We don't really know if the rich man looked right at Lazarus and just decided that he wasn't worth his time and energy, or if he just straight up didn't notice him. Regardless, we know that he was living in a world where his position as a rich person afforded him a certain place in the social hierarchy. One would think that his illusion of his position would have been shattered by the burning flames consuming him, but instead, what we see is a man who, even when his own arrogance is made completely obvious, he continues to operate under the same set of assumptions that he had been operating under when he was alive. The rich man, across this great chasm, doesn't even address Lazarus directly. He says to Abraham, "Send Lazarus to fetch me some water to cool my tongue." And then when Abraham says, that's not possible, he says, okay, then send him to be a messenger boy to my relatives. He's still wrapped up in his idea of himself as superior and deserving, and as Lazarus, as somebody who is less worthy, who should serve him. He completely fails to grasp the point, which is that we are not judged the same way by God as we judge ourselves and one another. Whether it's judging our parenting, our physical appearance, our masculinity or femininity, or our success as measured by promotions and money, we all have these ways that we compare. And the most insidious thing about it, which you may have noticed, is that we continue to apply these standards even when we have irrefutable proof that the standards are kind of stupid. We all know that money doesn't buy happiness, right? I saw a study recently that said there's like a diminishing returns on income where after a certain point, you don't get any happier no matter how much more money you make. It's like, I don't know, $60,000 or $70,000 a year for a family. And after that, it's like, you're as happy as you're going to be. And of course, we all know people, or maybe not personally, but know of people who have sort of disastrous family and personal lives, but they have a lot of money. It clearly doesn't make us happy. But we still have this idea in our head. We know that beauty standards change over time. There are some really interesting graphics that show like the ideal figure over the last 100 years, and it's changed dramatically. But we still see new cosmetic problems and the new products and procedures offered to fix them, and we hold ourselves to those standards. There's a part of us that really can't help this. We can't help living into the world's values, the world's conception of reality. Because in some sense, our ability to get along in the world is determined by our ability to hold ourselves to some of these standards. God's reality is different. This story acted as a blaring neon sign, calling the Pharisees into God's reality, where worth isn't determined by wealth or the ability to cross every T and dot every I in terms of the law. Instead, God is saying, your worth is determined by me, by my love for you. But as we know, these so-called righteous people continued to live in this way and eventually call for Jesus' death. Jesus' message is a call for a total overturning of the way of the world. And it's a real threat to people who are successful by these measures at times, like the Pharisees. The end of this story alludes to what's to come, saying, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead. We all know the end of the story. And Jesus is aware of what's to come and of the hard-heartedness of the Pharisees. Rather than simply calling the Pharisees to give to the poor, although this is definitely something he calls them and us to do, he's calling them to turn from all that they value in their little bubbles of piety and rightness to a true faith. By invoking the resurrection, Jesus points out yet another reversal to come, where might makes right and death has the final word, become the meek inheriting the earth. The truest reversal of our scarcity-driven fears is that the inevitable power of death is shattered through the humble healing power of love. I think what this parable calls us to is two things. First, we really need to strive to step beyond these bubbles, assumptions, and expectations and see where God is calling us to engage in relationship. We may not all be called to hop out of our cars every time we see somebody panhandling on the street corner, but we're all called to treat all of those that we encounter in our daily lives with respect and dignity, including acknowledging their existence in a way the rich man didn't. We may not all be called to political office, but we're all called to engage civically through voting, through speaking up in defense of the persecuted, and using our resources to foster justice. We're not all called to holy orders, to monastic lifestyles, but we're all called to serve and to find life-giving ways to listen to God's voice. This parable shakes us out of our cloisters and into the reality of suffering to see the humanity of those who are most vulnerable and to engage in the ways that we are called. Furthermore, it calls us to break through all of the nonsense and the garbage that the world teaches us to value and to let go of some of the idols that get between us and God. Whether those idols are chasing wealth, prestige, perfection. We are invited to turn our hearts to really see the reality of God's kingdom, where every human who has ever lived is evaluated not by stuff or productivity or sexuality, but by God calling and saying, I love you, you are mine. What I don't want is for you to read texts like this, and this text in particular, and wonder if you're giving enough to the poor or if you're doing Christianity right. What I hear is the promise of God, which is to be in relationship with us. And when we turn to God, we become reoriented to the world in a way more congruent with God's vision for it. We begin to see the new order of creation, not driven by competition and fear of not having enough, but by abundance and grace. The rich man's heart was so hard that he still couldn't fathom a world where a poor beggar was as valuable as him. And so our hearts sometimes hold on to these ideas and become hardened as we chase what the world values. This is Jesus' wake-up call, to let go of all you should be and do according to the old world, and instead, from the joy of being called sons and daughters in God's new creation, open your heart. Feed the poor, heal the sick, and love the despised. Not to live up to another expectation, but because as a beloved child of God, you have been fed, healed, and loved abundantly enough to share. Amen.